I'm John Lupson. I was born and bred in Ely. I was born in 1941 and I lived in Bohemian Street, Ely.
Right, thank you, John. Could you tell me then, John, your first recollections of the Roswell Pits?
I suppose the best recollection was I actually learnt to ride my bike. When you go down to Kiln Lane Crossing now, the pit on the left-hand side and right-hand side were grass fields. And that's where I first learnt to ride my bike, in the field on the left-hand side.
Right, John. You mentioned that, you know, your earliest childhood. I understand that on one occasion you went down and with your friends, you used to go down to the old railway bridge and learn to swim.
That's right, yes. a lot of the people who, or young lads and girls as well, from what we call Chinatown with New Barnes Avenue, was taught to swim there off the timbers, which used to guide the barges through the railway bridge. And there used to be quite a crowd down there some evenings. We used to have to walk from a Kiln Lane railway crossing along the side of the railway and just climb over the fence, and that's where they used to swim, a lot of them.
Right. I also understand that around about that time you also went to for Gudgeon on a Friday night.
That's right. In those days, food wasn't short, but I used to go catch Gudgeon on a Friday or in the week. And then Saturdays, me and my father would go out into the pits, the yachting club pit, and put deadlines in for eels. And we used to tie them to the old Corona bottles, and then on the Sunday we'd go out and pick them up and see what we'd got. And also, springtime, when the ducks were nesting, we used to have ducks' eggs. And the pits used to be full of coots in them days, but there's none about there now. And also coots eggs, but we never used to take all of them. Only one or two out of probably 10 or 15.
Right, thank you, John. You mentioned your grandfather. Can you tell me a little bit about your grandfather and his work?
This is what my father has told me. My grandfather actually, and my father, was born in Babylon, which is the other side of the river. And he actually started with horse and barge, and he used to cart coal from King's Lynn to Burwell Brickworks and Fertiliser Works, and then cart fertiliser back down to King's Lynn. And he'd done that for a lot of years, and then when my father was at school, he was doing this. And my father's told me that he bought a second horse, and that was his job when he came home from school to take the horse to meet him to give the other one a rest. And when they had to be shod, because they was the other side of the river, there's no bridge, they used to get the old horses to walk down and stand in a punt, and they'd punt them across the river, and they'd take them up into Ely, Brands, the blacksmith's shop, and have them shod. And then take them back, and they step in the punt and back across the other side of the river. And as I say, he'd done that for a long time. And then I don't know how it came about, but he then started what they call getting gold out of the pits to make the riverbanks up. And I assume then it was still horse and lighters, as regards not barges and such a thing. They were wooden lighters, which were smaller and got a point each end. They used to dig it by hand and wheel it down planks. And they'd never wheel them off the planks because they'd got steel wheels, and they used to run a groove in the plank so they didn't run off the planks. And my grandfather started digging the pits by hand. And
do you know when that was approximately, John?
He was born in 1904, and he said when he was at school. My father was born in 1910. So I would say probably 1920 or something like that, I suppose. 1910, 1915. Yeah. I'm only guessing, I don't know any particular dates.
Yeah. So he started off in the pit digging it by hand, John, as you were saying.
Yeah, that's right, digging by hand and putting in the lighters and taking it out to put on the river banks. And I think they used to puddle it in them days, dig a hole in the top of the bank, put the clay in, water it and puddle it and tread it in with the feet. I did see it in one book that they used to call them puddle trenches, and they used to do it by the feet. But nowadays they do it with a bucket. But,
right, John, you mentioned the role of your grandfather as foreman. Can you perhaps give me some recollections of his work and what he did?
Yeah, he was classed as outside foreman of south level in them days, and I understand he had 70 plus under him, and he used to pay them every Friday, you see, every individual man. And they tell me little tales about him, that if some of the men had done something wrong, or he thought they'd done wrong, he'd turn around and say, "You're sacked." And the next day he'd come back and said, "I've had a thought, you're reinstated." And several people have told me that about him. I can remember they bought him a motorbike, and it wasn't a sidecar as such, it was a wooden box. And he used to put a pillow in the box for me to sit on. And I used to go out round and about when he used to look after the men. And then they got a little bit better off, I think, the catchment board did then, and they bought him a van. And he lived up in Chinatown, as I mentioned before, and he was the only one up there that I can recollect who had a garage, because there was no vehicles about in them days, only this works van he had. And I used to sit on his lap and steer it across fields in them days, and I used to have many happy hours with my grandfather. And my dad's told me the tale that when he lived at home, my grandfather and him had a leather satchel, like the old school leather satchels. And my grandfather used to have the wages in that. And one Friday, my father picked the wrong bag up, thinking that was his docky bag. Got to work and got the wages, and I think my grandfather was going to sack him that night when he got home.
Yeah. Right, John, can you tell me about your grandfather and the 1947 floods?
Well, my grandfather was, as I say, outside foreman in the 1947 floods, and he had a lot to do with it, and he was awarded the MBE for the work that he'd done in the 1947 floods. He was also on a programme called Down Your Way, which was hosted by Richard Dimbleby. And they'd talk about any particular item, he spoke about the 47 floods. And as, not a surprise, but as a backup, they was allowed to pick a record. And my grandfather picked the record called The Dream of Olwen, which was Nan's favourite record. And that was on Richard Dimbleby on BBC, on the wireless. Not on no television in them days.
That's good. Just then, coming onto your father then, John, perhaps you could tell me a little bit about his working history.
I'm just trying to think when he started there. I can't remember. Let me think. I think he'd be about 19. So he was born in 1910. So he'd be about 1929, wouldn't it? I think it was about 19 years when he started here as a labourer. But prior to that, he worked in the slaughterhouse and butchers. Because he'd be a slaughterhouse in Ely down Willow Walk.
If you could then perhaps come to his role, you know, with the water board, well, in those, or sorry, the caption board in those days.
Yeah, well, I think my dad was about 19 when he started on the Great Ouse catchment board, as it was then. He was under my grandfather's wing anyhow, and he started actually in digging the pits where the yachting club is now, with a policeman excavator. He's told me several little tales and bits and pieces about while they was digging the pits and that. They found quite a few prehistoric bones. And they used to, him and the bargee used to sort it out and put in the barge, because they used to get half a crown a ton from the University of Cambridge. And they'd got quite a few lots of bones in there one Friday night when they packed up work. And when they came back Monday, they'd all gone. And there was quite a fuss kicked up about it, because that was their beer money gone. And he used to tell me a tale. The man he'd got as a bargee was a bloke called Bill Jones. And he... No, Dick Jones, sorry. He lived next door to my grandfather, and he got very poor eyesight. And my father's rescued him out of the pits many a time, because he's walked off the side of the barge. And my father's had to hook him out and dry him out, and he couldn't swim without a stroke. And he's told me many a tale of the pits when the water came up once, and the swan was trying to pick reeds up to make the nest up, and couldn't beat the water, so my father got a punt and scythed some reeds and took over to them, and they built the nest up high enough, same as they had the young ones. And my father used to feed them every day. He was in the Roswell pits, the old Roswell pits, where the yachting club is. That was the pit which was built in the first place, or dug in the first place, I should say. And they was into lighters first off, and then went into barges. And the tale is that the last barge would be going under the railway bridge, and the tug and the first barge would be in the main River Ouse. Not like it is nowadays, one barge, one tug, strapped to the side going through Ely. They used to have the bargees then, which would run the barges, slack the chains off to go round the bends and tighten them up on the straight. The lighters was a wooden boat. Father found that in the pit for him, because he knew where that was. And even when my son was born, he'd be about 4 or 5 year old when they lifted that one. And I went with my father and my son with those, because my father thought there was another one sunk further around, but he couldn't find it, not with the spread he'd got. But they never did find that one. But he showed them actually where that one was, which went to Cambridge. As I say, he told me many a tale of the watching a weasel, I think it was, had found a rabbit's nest, and it kept nipping in this rabbit's nest and taking the young ones out one by one. And my father didn't think much to that. I ain't going to tell you what he'd done.
Yeah. John, you were telling me earlier about the number of barges and tugs. Can you just remember roughly how many barges and tugs there were working at that time?
Well, at the Catchman Board, there, to my knowledge, there was a leader one, a leader two, a leader three. I think there was a four, but I'm not sure. The Knot, the Reed Hawk, the Sheldrake, the Vermoyden, and the Bedford. And I think there must have been at least 100 and some odd barges at that time. They'd also got a motorised barge, and I can't think of the name of it. And they'd also got an old lifeboat hull, which was called the Merle. I can remember that one, but it was just a work boat.
You also mentioned about the concrete barge that was sunk, John, and its recovery.
Yes, as you go over Kiln Crossing, the pit on your left hand side, that was all built up with hedges then, but that was the pit where they kept the tugs and barges in, which they do now. But right along the side was a sunken steam dredger, and which now lays in the pit at the side of the river. But what they'd done was they piled across near the railway bridge of the pit, and they piled across the entrance to the pit, and they pumped the water out. And my father thought he was going to be in for a nice lot of eels when it got down lower. And that they had the fisheries people there and they was in the bottom catching the fish as the water got down lower, and my father was lifting dustbins full of them out and putting into the pit with a 10RB. And my father was really disappointed because he only got one eel, because the eels went in the mud. But they sank pontoons down the side of the dredger and then pumped water back in, and that lifted the dredger up, and they towed it out and let it sink in the far pit. It was made of concrete, the dredger was. If the water's low, you can see the concrete dredger lay there. Jib wasn't on it and the boiler wasn't on it or anything like that. It was just a pontoon, if you like.
John, you mentioned your recollections as a young boy in the area. Can you give us some idea of what the locals used the area for in terms of recreation and other pursuits?
Well, fishing mainly, the pitch was. There was a small playground at the top of, which is now Lyle Lane, would be where the road is. That was a very small one. I think there was a set of goalposts in there, a couple of swings and a sandpit. That's about it there. But the common itself, that was always full of children in the summer, with the kale parsley and hide and seek in the kale parsley all the way down. Then we'd come across this road, and in the far corner used to be a walnut tree, which I don't think is there now, but we used to get the walnuts from there, and we was always in the pits. No flowers, and there wasn't actually any trees along the side of the road that I can remember. It used to be cut for hay in them days. And as I say, and there always used to be somewhere there a mushroom ring. We always used to get mushrooms there. Never ever remember any cattle or horses on there.
Okay, John, thank you for that. Could you perhaps now come to your own working career and perhaps just your recollections of your first job at the beef factory?
Well, I left school Christmas 1956, and I should have started work on the 7th of January 1957, but I had to go to technical college at Bury that day, and I started my apprenticeship when I was 16. We had to do 12 months and then start a 5-year apprenticeship, and so we finished when we was 21. It was good days, nice time there. We was all classed as either a mechanical engineer or an electrical engineer. The apprenticeship, you went throughout the whole of the factory. You was in the boiler house, conveyors, pumps, vehicles. You'd done a drawing office, everything while you was an apprentice there. It was a brilliant apprenticeship. And then I was one of the chosen few or lucky ones. I was sent on outward bound school at Elgin in Scotland for 1 month in May, and I was lucky because it was the hottest May I think ever in Scotland, which was a bit of a tester for you when you're used to going out nights. You were 17 year old, and they turn around and say, "No smoking, no drinking, you'll be in bed by 9, which was a bit of a come down for us all. But after 2 nights, I think we was all in bed by 7, because we was wore out. Well, it was always very interesting, funnily enough. We had a good tutor during the campaign, because he had to look after all the apprentices during the campaign. And he used to set us tasks, and he used to mark us out of 10, and he'd always say to us, "You'll never get 10 out of 10, because no one's perfect in this world." He said, "You'll never get 10 out of 10. But as apprentices, he used to treat us very, very well. I can remember once there, the manager walked through the factory, and molasses was dripping on the floor, right in front of the officers. And he looked up at it, shook his head, and the man who was in charge was, he called Brummy Blake away. He was a Birmingham man, self-taught welder, lovely man. He said to Brummy, he said, "I'd like to get rid of that drip," he says. He said, but I can't stop the factory. Bummy says, I'll get rid of that for you. He said, you can't, not without stopping the factory. He said, I can. He said, but it'll cost you 20 senior servers. He said, well, all right then, you try it then. When he went home, which was on a Saturday, and we used to work all day Saturday then, he sent one of us to the stores to get a bucket, and we put a nipple in the bottom of the bucket and a piece of rubber hose pipe down to a drain and hung the bucket under the drip. When he came in, he looked, went to the canteen, bought 20 senior servers and chucked on the table for us apprentices. And many a tales like that we used to do. He used to look after us like we were his sons. He treated us really well. He used to live down Deacon's Lane.
So after you finished your apprenticeship then, John, what was your role then?
When I finished my apprenticeship, I was in what they call the yard garage, looking after the locos, the dumpers, excavators, loading shovels and things like that. And I don't know whether I should say this or not, but there was a outside foreman's job came up, so I put in for it. Mr. Lubienski, who was the works manager, interviewed me and said, why did you put in for the job? I said, well, I think that's the best paid job for the least amount of work. He said, well, I'll tell you now, he said, you won't get the job. He said, because you're too valuable doing the job you're doing. I said, oh. I said, well, I don't think much to that. He said, well, that's how it is. I said, oh, righto. And from that day onwards, I started looking for another job.
Right. And your next job then, John, was?
I went to work for Dickerson's at Landbeach Concrete as a fitter there. With another ex-apprentice who was a blacksmith apprentice, Ian Washington from Littleport. We both went there. I was looking after the lorries and the loading shovels and things there. And I didn't reign long there, I'll be quite honest with you. He came in, Lenny Dickerson this was. There was Len Dickerson who had the block making place where we was. And John Dickerson had the sand and gravel at the front, and they used to hate each other's guts, the pair of them. They hated each other. And Lenny came from Guernsey one week, and he gave all the operators and that a pay rise, but not the fitters. So we went in the office and asked him, which was on the Friday, and he said, you cost me money. Yeah, well, we argued and argued and argued, but he wasn't going to give us anything. He said to me, what am I doing tomorrow, which was Saturday? I said, I'm putting a clutch in the Albion lorry. He said, and how long will that take you? I said, 6-7 hours. Right, he said, I'll come with you and we'll do it in half the time. I said, okay. He said, what time will you start? I said, 7 o'clock. So I get set at 7, I bring the Albion lorry and put it over the pit, start on it, and the foreman come in. I said, where's Lenny then? Leonard. He said, he's gone home. I said, oh, right. I put all my tools in my toolbox, put my toolbox in the car. He said, where are you going? I said, home, I'm finished. He said, you're finished? I said, I wanted Lenny here. He said, why? I said, well, he weren't going to give me a pay rise, was he? He said, no. I said, but he'd been in Addenbrookes by 10. He said, why? I said, because I'd have rolled the gearbox on top of him. He said, oh, right. With that, Ian Washington turned round and said, you never mind, notice as well, because I'm off as well. And we left. On the Monday, I went to Cambridge. On the way home, I come back through Water Beach, and Jack Branch has got a big notice up outside his, fitter required. I said, so I went in and saw the foreman. He said, when can you start? Can you start tomorrow? I says, no. I said, I'm going to have a week off. And that's the only week off, touch wood, in my whole life I haven't been in work. And I worked for Jack Branch then for 5-6 years doing the lorries. And then they was bought out by another firm, Kerridge's I think it was, and they was going to move in with their fitters, and I thought, oh, this is me, finished, last in, first out. So I started looking for another job, and applied for one with Power Stream Engineering, which doesn't mean a lot to any people in Ely, I don't suppose. They made high pressure water pumps, and they was going to start in Angel Drove at the new state down there in them days. And I was lucky to get a job with them, and I went to Billingshurst in Sussex for 3 weeks at their factory there, and then they opened the factory at Ely, and I was with them for a few years. I travelled with them to France, Poland. I had 3 weeks in Poland, and well, several places in America, and then it got same as I've got two children, and I was working away from home most of the time and getting home weekends and off again, and I was getting a little bit fed up with it. And then the Anglian Water advertised a job. They wanted a plant fitter and a vehicle fitter, so I applied for it, and they offered me the plant fitter's job. Hence, I started there in 78 and finished in 2004. But my father was foreman at Anglian Water, but I wouldn't apply for a job while he was there. Fathers and sons can't get on.
Right, thank you, John. So when you joined Anglian Water, you were based down at the workshops. What was your first recollections of the type of work and the kind of environment down there?
Well, when I first started there, the new workshops wasn't there. It was being built then. And I started in what they called the Romney Hut, which is still stands there. And the workshop that the Environment Agency had got there was the machine shop with the lathes and the drills and everything in. It was, what should I say, basic. Yeah, there was no overhead cranes to help you and this, that and the other, and it wasn't a case of pulling them in with a bulldozer and pushing them out with a bulldozer. But in those days they owned 18 22 RBs, two Priestman Cubs, two 10 RBs, two Priestman Mustangs, two Massey Ferguson 450Ss. They was all excavators, and then you'd got your tractors and grass cutters on top of that, and you covered Bedford, Lynn and Ely.
Presumably in those days that the work in the pits had then ceased, had it, John?
No, they still worked the pits. There's a photograph that I've got there, and also a photograph in the workshop taken from the bottom of the road, showing the excavators on the top here.
And how many would there be in the pit at that time then, John? Can you remember?
Excavators,
yeah.
When I started here, probably one. But then they bought, they decided they was going to do the loads, burl load, with clay, and they bought some 8-ton Goliath dumpers, and they got the clay out of the pits at Burl to put on the banks.
Yeah. So when you came back, when you worked to the Anglian Water then, that was more or less at the end of excavation from the actual pits?
Yes, they actually did get some clay out of this pit, what you've got here then, but this pit had already been dug before I started here in 78. Very little took out of here, I don't think, after that.
No. In those days, presumably, any material would have mainly probably been taken by road, would it?
That's right. In the, they used to take it in the little grey Bedford tippers, short wheelbase yeah. tippers. When I started, I think there was only about two here, plus some two longer wheelbase TK Bedfords. I think Lynn had a couple of short wheelbase tippers, but then they bought two 6-wheel Bedfords to fetch K car stone down from Midlands, I think they used to cart it, to sink the mats at Lynn.
Yeah. And when you started angling water, how many barges and tugs can you remember still operational?
Tugs, two. And barges, I should say, probably 20, I don't know, and probably not even 20. I can actually remember going with Tony Sale to Thames Water because they made two barges for us. Probably, when was this? Probably 2000, year 2000, 2001. I think Thames Water made us two barges. It was the last two barges I ever know made. I mean, my father used to make the barges years ago.
And did he make them down at the workshops?
Down at the workshops. They all used to be riveted barges in them days. And he used to have what they called DPs, displaced persons. They came, one from Estonia. I think he was named, they used to call him Willie Ooges, and he still lives in Ely. He married an Ely girl. Charlie Gordwins, he died a few weeks ago, age 93. And another one, Joanne, and he was as strong as a lion, he was. I've been with my father with him. Dad had to cut some pipe work out at Soham Low Pumping Station, and there was no road to pump Soham Low Pumping Stations in them days. You used to walk it. And my father helped get an oxygen cylinder on Joanne's back, and he walked her down to the pumping station, put it down, and he walked back again, he put the acetylene bottle on, and he walked down and put that on. My father done the curtain, and Joanne walked the bottles back. In them days, they had a mobile crane. I can remember a JER777 registration. It was an old Scammel X RAF chassis, and they put a Priestman Cub on the back of it. And I've been miles and miles in that. And Joanne used to go with my dad, and dad used to come round, park up the top of the road, come up with his breakfast. Joanne used to go to the Belgian shop and get me some sweets. And we've been, as I say, miles with that. And they used to lift in weed boats, and the front wheels would be off the ground, but they still used to carry on lifting in them days. Never did tip over. And during the 1953 tidal wave, my dad had got that crane, and he was going down to King's Lynn with it every day to put pumps in. And I never see him for a fortnight, but he come home to sleep every night. But he didn't used to get home till I'd gone to bed and be gone before I got up in the morning. And that crane was doing 0.6 miles to the gallon, petrol. Talking about the barges, they used to make the barges. There used to be two gangs in there. My father had a gang and Don Bailey had a gang. And they'd always want to get in my dad's gang because it was easier riveting with him. This is what I've been told. You'd have one man hotting the rivets up. One man would catch him. One man would drop it down inside for the man to put through the hole and dolly up behind it. And my father used to be on the outside of the barge with a hammer and rivet it up with an air hammer. But my father always used to hit it once on the side to lock it and then hammer it. Says there's no weight going on the man dollying up behind. But Don Bailey didn't. He used to hit that rivet straight on the end. Well, the man behind, that was taking all his shock up his arm all the time. And my father used to have days and days and days riveting, and his hands were like iron. He could put his hands on the table, and I used to hit him as hard as I could. That didn't used to hurt his hands. It was really hard.
Right, John, can you just tell me about your recollections of the 1947 floods?
My only recollections is that remember coming down to everybody in our family knows it as the yard, down the bottom depot, and going round to where the old slipway used to be, There was a duck boat moored there, and you had to go up steps to get into it because the water was so high. Nowadays, you have to go down about 10 steps to reach the water. And I can remember also, because my aunt lived in Victoria Street, going down to see her, and the water was up Victoria Street a little way. And that's basically, I don't know much else about the 47 floods.
Yeah, no, thank you, John. The next bit I was going to ask you about was the, your recollections of the work on the to improve the river and the situation with the barges belonging to the Beet Club, or the Beet Factory, sorry.
Beet Factory. Derek Crouch was the one who'd done the river, and I think it was 1962-63. That'd be 61-62, because 63 was the big freeze. So that is finished by then. So, but they bought the barges, which the Beet Factory had finished with, used to cart beet with. At the time, when I first started there, they used to bring beet in by barge. But Derek Crouch bought all those, and because they've got wooden floors, they used to break the bottoms out of them. And my father had them in, a lot of them. He worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, they did, repairing them, putting the concrete in. And they bought some of the tugs and some of the angling water tugs. No, it wouldn't be angling water, they had Great Ouse Riverboard in them days. And I can remember being up in the drawing office at the Beet Factory at the time and during the campaign, and seeing a tug and barges coming down the river. I can't remember any barges, there were four or five, and all the barges gradually sunk as they was coming by. But I wasn't up in the drawing office when they got them back up again, so I don't know how they got them up, I said, but they definitely got them up. They didn't leave them there.
John, you mentioned to me about your knowledge of the Blue Lagoon. Can you just explain what the Blue Lagoon was and what happened to it latterly?
The Blue Lagoon was one of the, not the last pit, I don't think, to be started on or got clay out of, but it was called the Blue Lagoon mainly because the water was a blue like a swimming pool, and I think the reason it got filled in the end was a young lad from the King School drowned there, and soon after they started to fill it in with soil from the Beet Factory. The other side of the river is what they called the Settling Ponds, and I think there was three if not four there, and they pumped the dirty water over there to wash the beet off of, and let them settle over a number of years. Well, they got to the stage where all the ponds was getting full up, and they've got to get rid of the soil, and they offered it to anybody who wanted any free of charge. And they decided that they could fill this Blue Lagoon in with that soil, and I think it took about three off seasons to fill the pit. Darby's tip of lorries were cart, yeah. And there's also, so if they ever start digging there, there's some bones in there as well, because I don't know who he was, but he came from London and he had a flatbed lorry, and he used to stand sleepers up around it for soil, but he'd got sheep on the washers, and they'd got drowned on the washers. And he got these sheep on the lorry, and he didn't know what to do with them. He didn't want to take them back to London, but he wanted a load of soil as well. So they put the sheep in one of Darby's tippers, and he went off to London with his soil, and Darby's tipper had a load of soil and some sheep and tipped in the pit. I think there's about five sheep in there somewhere, or bones of five sheep in there somewhere. Yeah. And also when I worked down there, they put a notice in the Ely Standard, free soil, free loading. The summer holidays, and two or three, I don't know, it's three or four children pushed a pram up onto the pit bank, and the driver said, "What are you after?" "Soil, mister. Dad sent us for some soil." "Oh, well, we'll soon get you some soil." filled it up for them the way they went, thinking that was it. They come back the next day, want some more soil, mister. So they didn't have no more to do. They got in touch with the paper and they hung this bucket over the top of the pram and he jiffled soil into the bucket, in the pram, out the bucket for them. And that was put in the Ely Standard.
John, just going back to the Blue Lagoon, can you just explain to me where the Blue Lagoon was?
The Blue Lagoon is, if you go to the Yachting Club and bear left at the Yachting Club and go down to the loop line, the field on your left-hand side was the Blue Lagoon. And that stretched the whole of that field, covered the whole of that field. That was the Blue Lagoon.
How long did your grandfather and father and yourself work for the catchment boards and drainage boards, John?
Well, my grandfather, he done 55 years and was actually on a retainer till the day he died. But if they wanted him, he'd come back. And they used to go and ask him if he wanted to come out for a ride. He said, no, I'm finished. I'm not coming out no more. My father done 46 years and I done 27 and a half, which takes us up to 2004.
Right, thank you, John. I understand that there's a nice interesting little anecdote about a retirement celebration in one of the local hostelries.
Oh, my grandfather's retirement. Yes, I was probably about 8 or 9 then. And I was up with my nan when she came back, because she went down first and they presented them with 2 armchairs. And she came back, didn't want to join the drinking afterwards. And my nan looked after me up there. And then my mum came home from there, and dad's sisters and brother-in-laws all came home. Brother-in-law said, we've come home because we think we'll be needed later to carry a few home. And mum took me home to bed, and they was right. I don't think my father was carried home. He was dragged home because he went out with a new pair of shoes and come home with no toes in them. And they tell me that he's sitting in one armchair and my grandfather sitting in the other armchair, and they'd both got a bowl for the night. And my father had to come and apologise on the Monday to Mr. John or Jack Chapman, because he'd called him a name, called him a bald-headed so-and-so. He had to apologise to him, but it was all took in good heart.
Right, thank you, John. Just going back then to the digging of the Roswell pits, and you were talking about those early days and access. Could you just explain a little bit how you think that the workings were advanced?
Well, they started digging them by hand, and there's bits and pieces in a book called Ely Memories from different people, and the only way I could see possibly that they started digging the pits was from Turbutsy, because in the pictures what are shown of Turbutsy, there is sort of a flooded area heading towards the pits, and in one of the books it says that they actually widened the bridge over the railway because the lighters used to go through, which were narrow wooden boats, what they used in the first place, and then they upped them to bigger barges, and the bridge was actually widened. I said, but I can't remember which book it's in, but it's in one of them.
John, you also mentioned about your father and his putting together some kits, quite large kits. Can you explain what that was about?
Yes, I think the leader 1, the leader 2, and leader 3, and possible 4 were, for want of a better word, like a Meccano. They came in kit form, already drilled and put together and riveted, and they was done in the old slipway, which was the one near Cuckoo Bridge.
And he's also telling an interesting story about the riveting gangs.
Oh, yes, yeah. They used to be 4 men in a gang. One man would heat the rivets, and he would pick them out of the forge with a tongs and throw it up to the man on the barge, who would catch it in a gloved hand, drop it down to another man in the barge with a gloved hand, who would put the rivet through. And then my father used to be on the outside and hammer the rivets up with an air gun, but he always used to hit them once on the side to heal it, as they said, and then he'd rivet up, and then the man at the back didn't get so much pain going up his arms dollying up.
You also mentioned that these kits were to do with the war effort. What was the word terminology you used, John?
The word I heard was warag, but what warag means I don't know. Whether they was built or made for probably war effort or not, I don't know.
Okay, that leads me nicely on to the Home Guard, John, your reminiscence from your father and his work with the Home Guard locally.
Yeah, my dad was in the Home Guard. I don't know much about it. He always used to tell me the tale. The only thing he'd done in the Home Guard was sleep in the cemetery and sleep on the flour bags in Belgian's bakery, because they always said if any Germans dropped in, that's the most unlikeliest place they'd think about looking for them is in the cemetery. And I can add another little bit. How true this is, I don't know. There used to be someone, I think they were called Bangley, or Bangley's goat used to be in the cemetery. And one of the Home Guard blokes laid down, and when he woke up in the morning, he'd got a hot water bottle against his back. The goat had laid down the side of him.
And also, you were telling the story about the going back to your days at the beet factory and what happened there during the war in the Home Guard.
Well, this was a tale that was told when I was down the beet factory. I won't mention their names, who was supposed to be the head of the Home Guard there, because there's some of his family still alive now, I think. But he asked the Somme Home Guard to attack him, but not to tell them when they was coming or anything like that, just attack them when they thought they wanted to. Well, in them days, and when I was there, there used to be a bus load of workers come from the beet factory every shift. So all they'd done was lay on the floor of the shift bus when it came in, the Somme Home Guard. And the bus stopped, and as soon as the bus stopped, they flew out the bus with bags of soot and flour and bombarded the whole of the office. And the bloke who was in charge of the beet factory one said, "That's not playing the game."
John, can you tell me what a Galter is?
Well, the recollection I've got of a Galter is, which was my grandfather, he was classed as a Galter, as they dug clay out the pits, put it into barrows, walked it down the planks and tipped it into lighters, which were like a barge. And the best way they reckon in those days to recognise a Galter was the way he walked. His feet was like seal fins. They splayed out. And the reason for that is the plank was probably only about 12 inches wide, with a groove down the middle of it where the barrow had wheel, which was steel wheels in them days, not rubber tyres, wore a groove, and they'd never walk it off the plank. That was in the groove all the time. Rumour has it my grandfather had one which would carry a quarter of a ton and was put in the foyer of Brooklands Avenue in Cambridge. But I have never seen it, but that was the rumours.
John, can you tell us about what you used to do in the summer holidays with regard to your fishing?
Fished most days really in the summer holidays, but we used to get the best maggots, you wouldn't believe it, but from Page's, the butcher's shop in New Barnes Road. He was a fisherman himself, and of course he used to have the best maggots, and that's where we used to get ours from, the butcher's shop. Got the best ingredients.